Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. When listeners to NPR and St. Louis Public Radio want programming that is both interesting and intelligent, one of the first programs they turn to is American Public Media's award-winning On Being, heard here Sunday mornings. Host Krista Tippett has found a way to examine spirituality and the human condition in ways that take the discussion into all aspects of our lives. I'm happy to welcome broadcaster, journalist, and author Krista Tippett to our studio. She's here for an event at McKendree University this evening. We will, of course, welcome your input at 382-8255 via Twitter or Facebook and by email at stlpublicradio.org. Krista, so nice to see you again.
I'm so glad to be back.
Welcome to St. Louis.
Thanks.
You know, in promoting this program, I had a lot of response from young people, people under the age of 25, who were saying they were really excited to have a chance to listen to you here and hope that they could meet you somewhere along the way while you're in this area. And that surprised me a little bit. Are you surprised that there's a young audience out there for Krista Tippett?
Well, you know, a couple of years ago, we did a we were able to commission some audience engagement research. Mm-hmm. And I can't say it surprised me completely, but one of the findings of that was that there's a really robust younger audience, younger than the public radio audience in general.
Yeah.
And, you know, it makes sense to me because I think in general, those years of your teens and your 20s is a time of life where you are asking these great big questions of what life means and who you are and what you want to be. And I think that's been true forever. And also, we inhabit this world where a lot is up for grabs. You know, we are redefining a lot of things. And people who are now 18, 19, 20, 25, you know, they are stepping onto uncharted territory. And so I think that also intensifies some of these big existential questions of meaning. And that's how, you know, that's how I kind of understand it. But I mean, I have to say it's something I really love and not would not necessarily have predicted or certainly promised in the beginnings. But I felt in the last couple of years, I've really felt that energy, that young energy around the show grow.
Well, you know, I'm glad to hear that for any number of reasons. But the reason I was surprised is that younger people today seem so preoccupied with what you might call the Twitterverse and Facebook and dealing with things that seem less important. And we are observers because we can read what they're writing. So that's why I was surprised.
Right. Well, I just recently joined Twitter 3 months ago. Mm-hmm. And it took a lot of persuading. And I am a complete convert. So I think I've learned through this experience that, you know, all of these new media, these technologies, they are simply tools, and they are tools that we can craft as we wish to. And again, you know, I think to what I said a minute ago, I think that all this technology, in a very interesting way, we worry a lot about, is it alienating us from ourselves? Is it making us less social? Actually, I think precisely the opposite is happening. I think that all of this technology, you know, it's restructuring our days. It threatens to overtake our lives. But what, in fact, is happening in response to that, and I think the young are probably at the forefront of this, is people are understanding this is power. This is a huge opportunity. This is a way we're going to shape ourselves and the world. And I think a lot of people are stepping up to make that a really positive and, you know, I'd say edifying experience.
And they are, in fact, leading the way on this because basically it is a medium or media of today's young world.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how productive it has been, too. And we mentioned just off the air with regard to in journalism today, it's become a very, very important tool for instant communication around the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, a couple of years ago, I was invited to the Clinton Global Initiative, and it was an interesting invitation. It was actually younger people in the Clinton office who issued this invitation to me, and they wanted me to moderate the technology plenary session. Not the religion session, and it was, and the technology session, and they wanted me to shape the discussion around thinking about technology through a human lens. And one of the people on that the panel was Jack Dorsey, who created Twitter. And I was still at that point, and even until about 6 months ago, making fun of what you couldn't do with 140 characters. I no longer am, but one thing that was completely intriguing to me that's never left me is Jack Dorsey said then, this is a story I don't think a lot of people know, he created Twitter as a practical tool for emergency response workers in New York City. So in the very beginning, that technology was about people helping people. And he said, and he was 29, right, when I talked to him a couple of years ago, that he always envisioned this technology to be something that would bring people back to different kinds of face-to-face, you know, real-world encounter with other human beings. And I think, paradoxically, that's what we see happening, at least in places. It's not the whole story, but it's part of the story.
I hope young people who might be listening to this program don't think that in my comments I'm being critical of them. It's just I find it most interesting to see how all of this is evolving. Certainly, we all clearly recognize the importance of what's going on.
Yeah.
Krista, the last time we talked, you were in the process of doing a series of conversations on civility. That was a year and a half, 2 years ago, I think, something like that. And we're all well aware of the kinds of things that were going on then with regard to the political discourse and what have you. It's 2 years later now. Have things changed very much?
Oh, well, no. I mean, there's still a lot to be dismayed about. There's a little bit of a lull right now and kind of a relief because the election seasons are the worst, which is dismaying, right? Mm-hmm. And we've just come out of one. I feel like there's a period of relative calm. But the problem remains that so many of us feel discouraged and unrepresented in the basic ways we conduct ourselves in public spaces, the basic ways we have to take on the big questions of our time, as well as just the difficult, thorny issues of our time. I do feel that there's a lot of energy circling around wanting to take charge of this. And it's not happening. It's not about the political system changing. It's not about politicians changing. It's not about the media changing. But I think there are a lot of citizens kind of stepping up and saying, we can't live this way. And what may be changing is, I think for years, people just were disconnecting. And I was doing that too. Just, you know, I can't stand this. I don't want to be part of it. I'm not going to read newspapers. But just being disillusioned. And I think people are now saying, no, you know, we have to find ways to change that. We don't really know how yet. It's happening kind of one conversation at a time. But I do sense that.
That's interesting you say that because we've had occasion, obviously recently, to talk to a lot of politicians. And people, there are politicians, as you well know, who feel exactly the same way you and I do. And mm-hmm. We're thinking alike on all of this. And they're basically saying that it is going to take one person at a time to demand change until finally there is a very, very loud voice.
Really?
Out there.
That's so interesting to me that you're getting that from politicians.
Yeah. And not all of them, to be sure, but a significant enough number that I realize that they're beginning to say the same thing, which is unusual in and of itself. But that's difficult to do. It's difficult for, unless you have a microphone, as you do, and I do as well. It's difficult to have that megaphone to make the voice heard.
It is, and part of the realization for me, which behind these programs that we've continued to call the Civil Conversations Project, was after the Gifford shooting in Tucson. What was that? 2 years ago, 2000,
mm-hmm. Almost exactly. Yeah.
We suddenly had very beautiful speeches being given. You know, we had everybody from the president to major politicians to others standing up and talking about the need for civility, the importance of moral imagination, the urgency of social healing. And I think those words were so welcome for so many of us. But but what I was aware of is that we just don't have models of what those things look like. We don't have models of people who are very powerful being able to carry those things through and bring them to life. And so I think that part of the difficulty now is we are actually having kind of reinvent some basic aspects of civil society. You know, maybe we used to know how to do those things, maybe not, maybe we're romanticizing, but we are longing for those things. And yeah, that's the difficult work. It's kind of reinventing the wheel, and it's reinventing it again for this new century that has all these new ways we connect or are disconnected.
It is easy to be cynical, however, because, you know, you talk about Tucson 2 years ago. We had Newtown just a couple of months ago, yeah. And the same flowery speeches have been made. Yeah. There is some discussion now about gun control, some form of it, but you begin to get the sense that the grand things that were being proposed right after this tragedy are kind of dissipating now, and we'll wind up with something relatively small in terms of trying to solve it.
Right, and we tend to go to turning something into an issue or a debate. And, you know, after Newtown, it was gun control. And while I think that's a really important discussion, there's much more fundamental comprehensive work to be done that does have to do with us refashioning civil society. And that's going to take time, and it's going to happen much more quietly, and it's not going to be a matter of laws that are passed.
Yeah.
And so, what you know, I think what I try to do is, in my work, is find those people out there who are doing that long-term work and learning things and offering, you know, vocabulary and actually practical tools and you know, putting those on the air and offering them up for people to be using who are doing this work where they are.
Is there anyone you've spoken to recently who kind of fits the bill that you say this person has got it, and really we ought to turn the volume up on this particular person?
I do. You know, I want to say in general, there's an irony, which is a problem for our civic life, that the people who are, let's just say, that a lot of people who are doing the most nourishing, socially nourishing work are also people of humility. So they are the last people who are going to throw themselves in front of microphones, make headlines. And so, you know, people like you and I actually do have to look for them. Oh, I don't know. The person we had on the air this past weekend, Rami Nashashibi, mm-hmm. this young Muslim man in Chicago who founded this really an organization that is about social healing on the south side of Chicago. He's working with, you know, he started out working with principally focused on Muslim families and kids in trouble in a very difficult social situation. But it, you know, it's become an organization like all of our organizations must become now that is about community writ large. And he's working with rabbis and he's working with hip hop artists and he's working with people who do graffiti and bringing together all these elements of how, you know, how we are alive and bringing our voices into the world. You know, there are people like that everywhere. Mm-hmm. So I think there are lots of them.
Just plain folks.
Yeah.
Not, they don't have the celebrity. They don't have the power, but just plain folks working in the trenches.
And people who are close to whatever needs to be healed or worked on, right? Do you know, experts and politicians often that are necessarily at a remove from those things.
They don't move on the streets.
They can't.
In the
yeah,
neighborhoods.
They
no.
can't. Yeah.
Krista Tippett is my guest. She is the host producer of On Being, which is heard here Sunday mornings at 10 o'clock. She's in town for a speaking engagement tonight at McKendree University. I understand that you're sold out for tonight. But,
That's nice.
Not everybody will be able to hear you tonight, but they are able to hear you today on St. Louis Public Radio. We'll be back in just a moment to continue our conversation and bring you into it. We'd love to hear from you at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email to talk@stlouispublicradio.org. You can send us a tweet at STL on air or also reach us through Facebook. Back with more with Krista Tippett in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation with Krista Tippett. Krista, the address you're making tonight, which too many of us will not have an opportunity to hear, is Wit, Wisdom, and Responsibility. How do you tie those three things together?
Well, Wit, Wisdom, and Responsibility is apparently a theme at McKendree University, which I think is just beautiful because as proud as I am of this civil conversations work we're doing, I worry about the words. I worry about the word civility and civil conversations. I haven't been able to come up with anything better, but it's, you know, these kinds of words are in danger of just sounding a little too safe and a little too bland and like we're, anyway, just, you know, just that. I feel like we need fresh language. And so that wit, wisdom, and responsibilities, I have to credit McKendry with that. And I'm going to talk about what I like. One way I talk about it is the adventure of civility. So I'm going to talk about this at the Civil Conversations Project. I love that the synergy between those different words. And, you know, so I think introducing wit into the equation suggests what I say. I think the limits of those words are that this is something about being savvy and passionate and having a sense of humor as well as a sense of purpose. And I would say that those are, as well as wisdom, you know, bring that together with wisdom. That's a really powerful, exciting combination. And I would say that those are qualities and characteristics of the people who I point out there who are getting this right and can teach all of us.
It would be great if all of us had all of those three attributes. There's no question about that. Not unexpectedly, we have a lot of people who want to get into this conversation, Krista. So let's bring them in and give them a chance to chat with you. And we'll begin with Tom. He was our first caller. So we'll start with Tom calling from Ferguson. Thanks for waiting, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. It's great to speak with you.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. My question is this. The criticisms that you both have of a lack of civility, it really sounds to me like a focus on style over content. And I don't really understand what you're talking about, because if you're saying that people aren't saying something civilly, you're kind of dismissing their conversation. It's sort of another way of hijacking the conversation, being uncivil. I think what's important is the content of the conversations that we have. I think focusing on civility is just a tendency that we all have as we get older to be curmudgeonly. But civility, being critical of civility is exactly the same as being curmudgeonly, in my opinion. It's not appreciating the different styles of conversation that have arisen over the years. And if you want to give me a specific example of when people were being uncivil and a way that they could have acted more civilly, I'd certainly be interested. Thanks, and I'll take my comments off the air.
So I think you're pointing in a helpful way at what I was not saying very well a minute ago. I mean, I think you're absolutely right that what matters is the content. I mean, the tone matters too, because the tone can determine the content. But I'm not interested in civility as a phrase that suggests that this is about being nice. You know, I'm concerned when we're not listening to each other, when the way our conversations are framed is not actually at all about listening or about understanding what the other person has to say. I think that robust civil society has to be about us being able to hold very different positions passionately and still find a way to be communicating with each other, to be living together, sharing life, creating our common life, even while we hold these different positions as best we can, as interestingly as we can. So, you know, when I think about an uncivil conversation, or when I think about something that is in contrast to what I am pursuing as civil conversation, it's not just that it's not just the kind of talking heads, or, you know, what's usually more like screaming heads is what we have in a lot of our debates. It's that, in fact, we're not going anywhere. That you know, what we do on a lot of these issues, the hot button ones come immediately to mind. Guns is the one that's out there now. But, you know, it's abortion. It's gay marriage. Maybe it's the budget. We just retread the same old dead end discussions. It's completely predictable what's going to happen. You get somebody who's for, you get somebody who's against. I want us to have conversations that start a little in from the edges, right? Not the extremes on either side, but those of us who are right of center, left of center, and have a lot of questions alongside our answers. And have a desire to create a common life together with people on the other end of the spectrum, even if we don't agree with them. And when you start a conversation there, very different things happen. It's not necessarily easier. But you get somewhere.
I think there is some confusion out there too, Krista, between the use of the words. Now, civility is one word and another is rude. And the two aren't necessarily the same thing, but there's a lot of rudeness out there as well,
yes,
that people are calling a lack of civility.
Yeah, and this is actually not unimportant, right? I talk a lot about, you know, some of the basic virtues that I think can help us, can be useful, and really simple ones. And I don't think we should start with things like forgiveness and compassion and love, but those are hard. We can start with something like hospitality. Mm-hmm. You know, hospitality is an incredible virtue. And again, a sophisticated, complicated idea of hospitality. Hospitality is not just issuing an invitation. Hospitality is creating an atmosphere. You know,
it's welcoming.
Yes, welcoming. Yeah. It's the whatever the civic corollary would be of lighting candles and cooking a meal and making someone feel welcome. And you can be hospitable if you don't disagree with someone. You can be hospitable if you don't like them. So the atmosphere you create, and Dawn, you know this in your conversations, and I know it on mine. It's true one-on-one. It's true collectively. The atmosphere you create does absolutely inform and shape what happens mm-hmm. between you. Mm-hmm. So it's not that that's unimportant, but that, you know, that's one ingredient.
Yeah. Another ingredient is the word wit, which I bring up because that's very helpful, is
yes.
it not? I mean,
yes.
Wit, humor, and yes. that can be very, very helpful.
Yes.
Back to the phone. Steve is on a cell phone. Steve, I hope it's hands-free if you're driving.
I parked.
There you go.
Thank you for taking my call. And, Krista, I love your program, but I'll move on so we can be brief. A couple of observations, although I have another one that's stimulated by what you just said. I'm sure you know about Roger Fisher and William Ury and getting to yes. And what you said sounded so much like that. That is, be hard on the problem and soft on the people and talk about what your interest is instead of being prescriptive and tell the other person what they should do and what they're doing wrong. And we might find a lot more common ground. But my real observations were these two. First of all, I'm old enough that I remember World War II, and I'm really nostalgic for the sense of community we had there, where everybody was involved, and we were doing scrap drives and making them bigger than our grade school, and we were saving our fat, and we were turning them in for red points, and women were working in factories, and they were welcomed because we really needed them, and on and on. I mean, there was a real sense of purpose and community, and I would love to see a way for the country to get back to that. And my last observation, which is a little mundane, is I think, in spite of what you said about kindness, if you can put a little kindness in your day every day, if each one of us does, and my resolution is I'm trying to do it when I drive, because I remember once driving down Highway 40, and I cut some woman off, and she gave me a finger with both hands, and I thought, that's dangerous, and I had to stop that. So I try to give other people a little bit of right-of-way, and you'd be amazed how happy it makes them. If we could all do that, and we'd make our society a little more happy.
Thanks, Steve.
Great, great comment, Steve. I mean, just to your last point, it follows on this idea of hospitality. It's true with interviewing, but it's true in just daily interactions that the spirit in which you ask a question or approach another person is likely to elicit a like-minded response, right? Not always, but kindness is likely to elicit a kind response. Generosity is likely to elicit a generous response. And the opposite is also true. So, yeah, I mean, I think that way of moving through the world is very powerful and can be transformative. You know, in terms of the World War II analogy, you know, that's hard. I mean, there is something that happens in times of crisis and urgency and common threat that brings people together. A story I love that I really hold up as a model is Dorothy Day, the Catholic social activist. She was a six-year-old girl when the San Francisco earthquake hit. And the story is that she, you know, walked outside her door, looked around, saw people, total strangers, you know, rallying to take care of each other. And she asked this question, you know, why can't we live this way all the time? And to me, I talk sometimes about something that I think I feel like I'm trying to draw out, which is, you know, spiritual genius. You know, what is the art of living? What is spiritual genius? That's actually a phrase of Einstein. And I think that the spiritual geniuses of the ages and of the everyday, you know, that is a question that they ask, as Dorothy Day did when she was six, and then they live that question. Not that we have to have a war, or who knows, we may have some climate disaster that's going to necessarily bring us together in the next generations, but that we decide to live that way all the time, and then we translate into, and maybe the way you're talking about, you know, simple acts of kindness as you go through the day is one way to live that question.
I wonder what causes that feeling to dissipate. I mean, you saw it most recently after 9/11. You know, the country was together and total lockstep on this, and then it just kind of went away. And actually led, it was the precursor to what we're talking about today, the civility problem.
Yes. Yeah, and so there's something natural. There's something natural both about the way we come together and the way we then drift apart. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder about intentionality. You know, what if we all decided that we would figure out what it would take to continue to be that way? I think we're capable of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly would be a wonderful goal, a wonderful objective, and is, but reaching it is problematic, needless to say. Let's come back to the phones and bring in Tom calling from St. Louis. Tom, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Well, Christoph, I am overjoyed that you're in St. Louis. I listen to your program every opportunity that I get. And it really strikes me, what strikes me the most is two things, the questions you raise and then the space you create for them. And it's the space of being that's on your program. So two things I'd like to say here after that is that I never heard of Kendrick Seminary or Kendrick University, is it?
McKendree University.
But it puts it really on the map that they've asked you to come into town and speak. And so I so hope somebody else also has you come in town and speak so we can all see you in person. Now, the second thing, back to the question, is as we look at the world view that we have, it's based out of material science. It's based out of the tremendous breakthroughs in physics. And at the same time, it's a very impersonal, dispassionate study that's been the basis for that to come into existence. But the other side of it is being is very personal. So what is your view? Which exists first? How do you reconcile this? You've chosen on being, which I think is spot on. But can you elaborate on that if you get the gist of my question?
I think it's the question of the ages, but it's a great question, Tom. I want to tell you I'm thrilled to be at McKendree. I'm really impressed also with what I'm learning about them. But I also am on the board of advisors of the Senator John Danforth Center for Religion and Politics at Washington University. So I do have this connection to St. Louis that I really cherish, and I really love our listeners. I've always felt such a great community here of listeners. So I want to mention that. I actually have a scientist. I was just producing this show before I came to St. Louis yesterday. This is going to be on the air, I think, in 2 weeks. And it's a woman named Natalie Battaglia, who's an astrophysicist with the Kepler Space Telescope mission. And I feel like there are more and more of these voices in the world, you know, not people who've set out to reconcile these things, the material sciences with the challenge of being human. But I just feel like there are more and more people in the world today. And again, this is maybe a way that the young are going to lead us, who are kind of organically integrating these things. So, you know, I'm talking to this astrophysicist who's part of this mission to identify Earth-like planets outside our solar system that might be able to inhabit life. And she and her colleagues are absolutely convinced that within our lifetimes, we will be able to look up at the sky, or at least our children, grandchildren will look at the sky and say, you know, that we won't be looking at stars anymore. We'll say that, you know, that's a planet and there's life on that planet. And somehow seamlessly in her person, she thinks about love differently as a physicist, as an energy that, like dark energy in the universe, is kind of moving things and making things cohere in a way that we can't prove or view, but it's something we know to be true. she talks about science, and I think that somehow these, like Hubble and Kepler, these space telescopes are bringing science and the beauty of the cosmos and our place in it, you know, into our ordinary lives. And she really sees that virtue of science becoming real. So I think my answer to that is that I see this integration happening all around us. And again, it's kind of just a matter of looking and listening. And I want to promise you that I'm going to keep bringing those people onto my show because I think they're fascinating.
I have to take a break. Natalie Battaglia is a woman, needless to say.
Yes.
Do you find yourself these days speaking to more women?
Do I?
Yeah.
You know, this is something we think about a lot. We sometimes look at it, goes back and forth. You know, I go through periods where there are a lot of men, and recently I have interviewed a lot of women, and it's one of the many ways we try to talk about the breadth of what we're doing and making sure that there's balance. Do you feel like I'm interviewing more women?
I think more women are being interviewed by everybody, and
uh-huh.
I think they're playing a larger role in our society
yeah.
and our politics and everything else. That's why I ask it, because their presence, 51% of the population, you would think they'd have 51% of the time, but they don't, but they're getting there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, all right. Yeah. Krista Tippett is our guest. We'll take a break. We'll come back and continue our conversation. Take more of your calls. Stay with us. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again. Welcome back to our conversation with Krista Tippett. Let's go back to the phones. And Michelle has been waiting, so let's bring her into the conversation with Krista Tippett. Go ahead, Michelle.
Hi, Mr. Marsh. I'm just calling because I've been immersed in two different cultures, one BC, Canada, every 6 months, and then St. Louis every 6 months. And one of the biggest values that I've gotten out of this that I never thought that I would experience was two different cultures and the ways of speech that can be influenced by what I'm terming a virus. So as Valley speak used to be, upspeak was a virus in language. I think there's attitudes in virus in language that can be also construed as viruses. And one of the things that I noticed when I come back to the States, when I come back to St. Louis, is the oppressiveness of just even the, not to be mean to the weather people, but them telling me what kind of day I'm going to have depending on if it's rainy or cloudy or snowy, which I really resent, and which seems to go further into like just general everyday conversation with people. I find that the virus in our language here in the Midwest, from what I've gathered, is there's one of anger and judgment and just a lack of listening. And I like the idea of being hospitable to people, of what your guest speaker was speaking of, that there is a fear, a language of fear that seems to be really pervasive in this area here that is really, because I listen to the radio, I hear a lot of that. And I guess, you know, a lot of the hate radio and that sort of thing has really emerged into our everyday conversations and then we think that that's the way we should speak with each other and deal with each other. So I just really enjoy your show, and that's what I have to say. Thanks for listening.
Michelle, I this is something I think about a lot. I think about how powerful words are, and it's said to be a virtue of Americans that we're very creative with language, but there, I think that there can be a dark side of that, of also being careless with language. You know, Don, you said a minute ago that the post 9/11 world kind of shaped this culture that we're in now of fear and an adversarial culture. I think that's true. It's hard to draw that direct line, but there seems to be real truth in it. I think a lot about how right after 9/11, we had such a robust vocabulary of enemies and revenge. You know, we know how to talk about those things passionately. And certainly the experience of being attacked was real and needed to be talked about. But another aspect of that experience of 9/11 was a collective experience that was very unusual for Americans at that point in history, not that unusual for a lot of other people in the world, of knowing that we are vulnerable, you know, and that we build our strongest fortresses and even they are vulnerable. And we don't have a robust vocabulary to talk about that. And there's other language, like coming out of 9/11 that really, really disturbs me, and it's used by politicians all across the spectrum, this language of hunting down terrorists, right? You know, this is not a statement of whether I think terrorists should be brought to justice, whatever that means. But I think as soon as we start using words like hunting in conjunction with other human beings, that is language that dehumanizes and that will shape our behavior, will lead to dehumanizing behavior. So I agree. It's important.
Let me throw some more dots out there to connect, particularly since 9/11. And that is the role of media. Michelle alluded to that. You know, media became polarized. You look at the cable channels now, and you've got, you know, diametrically opposite points of view, and they are not shy about using very, very colorful language to make their point and to talk about people. I happen to think that this is a big part of this polarization, the lack of civility thing that we're talking about.
Yeah. The bigger point I want to make, too, is it doesn't get us anywhere.
Oh, true.
This is just an example
ratings.
That comes
it
to
gets
mind.
Ratings.
Right. On Twitter. I'm on Twitter now. I'm so proud of myself. you know, Pierce Morgan, right after the Newtown shootings, there was this tweet going around that I guess I went and watched this later, you know, people cheering him on for having someone from the NRA on and saying to this man, "You are an unbelievably stupid man, aren't you?" You know, that is just about as effective and, you know, powerful as it would be if an eighth grader said it to another eighth grader on a school playground. It gets us nowhere, but it makes the journalists look tough and interesting.
And I think of terms like feminazi, when we all know where that comes from. Terms like that, which are just bouncing around there all the time. That's why I speak of it in terms of being rude, you know, rather than in terms of being civil or not. Anyway, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Let's bring in Bijal. I hope I have that correct. Bijal, I think it is. Go ahead. Thanks for being with us.
It's Bijal. Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry.
That's okay. I wanted to just call in and say I'm a huge fan of the show. My husband and I listen regularly, and so we really appreciate that the conversation's happening on the air. My husband and I are from different backgrounds, and so we recently had a daughter. So we are raising a daughter in an interracial, interfaith, really intercultural marriage. And so we find this to be a really good platform to sort of introduce those themes to our daughter and just also to continue the conversation and dialogue between ourselves. My background is I come from a Hindu faith tradition, and he's Christian. And I actually find that a lot of the themes and content on this show resonate very well with Hindu philosophy and spiritual sort of concepts, but that Hinduism itself as a just the representation of Hinduism seems to be missing. I haven't heard that many shows where you have guests from that faith tradition and background, and so, you know, it's really important for us to be able to expose our daughter to that. And so I'm wondering if that's you know, if there's more coming up or more planned, or if that's for a reason in particular.
No, you know, Bijal, I really appreciate this, and this is actually something I'm concerned about. And you're right. I mean, we have had Hindu voices on the show, but not as many as we should have. I mean, first of all, I want to say how happy it makes me that you find the show helpful in your situation, which of course is a dynamic that so many people are living with, because our families now are intercultural and interfaith and interracial, and again, this is one of these new frontiers that so many of us are on. I would really welcome ideas. If you have ideas about Hindu voices you'd like to hear, I think a challenge with Hindu voices is that the tradition is not primarily verbal and ideas based. I don't know if you would disagree with that, but it's not a problem. It's a challenge in putting it on the radio. I find that a lot of Hindu, you know, the interesting Hindu practitioners and teachers. You know, it's so much about the arts and aesthetics and ritual and practice. And I mean, that's true of all the traditions, but I think it's so overwhelmingly true in Hinduism. And so it's just that much more challenging to find people who are going to be able to do justice just in words, like communicate the fullness of it in words. Some of the other traditions, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, you know, even Buddhism, they're very wordy. They're very verbal. So that's something I find. But I'm actually going out to USC to do the baccalaureate in the spring, and they have a wonderful young man, Varun Soni, who's he's not the Hindu chaplain of USC. He's the director of student life, and he's the first Hindu to be in a position like that at a major American university. And he's somebody I'm really interested in. And again, if you have ideas about particular people, please send me an email through the show and just mention that we talked on the air here.
Okay, I would love to.
Great.
Thank you for the call. There's an awful lot that we can learn from what might be called exotic cultures and religions that out of the mainstream, isn't there? I mean, you do a lot of programming with just such folks.
Yes, and also something I try to do is, you know, it's one thing to talk about religion. We don't do really that much of that. Mm-hmm. It's more I want to get, and this is probably the better way to get into Hinduism or anything, is I want to find really interesting people who are living in this tradition, and they're bringing it into a 21st century life. And, you know, again, they are an astrophysicist, or they are a teacher, or they are a poet. So and that's where you actually learn so much more about the depths of something, because you learn about how it infuses the life in the world, as opposed to it being a set of principles.
Back to the phones. And let's have Lee join us. Lee, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. It seems to me that the founding fathers were so virtue-centered, and I'm troubled. Virtue has almost disappeared from public life. We don't hear politicians talk about virtue, almost out of a fear of political correctness. How do we bring the founding fathers' vision of virtue, or Aristotelian virtue, back into American life?
Oh, I love that question. I love the word virtue. This is one of these words I would just re-inject. And it's a word that I think is very magnetic for people. And as you say, it has a rich lineage. I would point you to a show that we did. I think we put it on the air maybe on the 4th of July last year with Jacob Needleman, a philosopher, who actually, that's precisely what we talked about, the founding fathers, and he wrote a book about them, and about the virtues that accompanied all the rights. We talk so much about our rights, but every right had a virtue attached. You know, rights had responsibilities attached, and that's what made this country great, right? That is what provided us this framework and these framing principles and documents that are so profound and so thick and have been so durable. I'm spacing out on the name, what we called it, but Jacob Needleman, if you look at onbeing.org. And I don't know. I mean, how do we reinject that? I'm trying to do it in my way. I think you should try to do it in your way, wherever you are. And I think you will find people very responsive when you state it like that. So many people realize, yes, yes, that's what we're missing. That's what we want to rediscover.
I'm just advised here that the inward work of democracy.
The inward work of democracy.
Right,
yeah,
right.
Love
okay.
that. Yeah.
We thank Alex Hoyer, the producer, for that. I'm reminded of a song, and I guess it was a poem first. If everyone lit just one little candle, what a bright world it would be. And that's kind of what we're talking about, isn't it? Rebecca, thank you for waiting. You're on the air with Krista Tippett.
Well, thank you so much for taking my call. Sure. I listen to both of your shows regularly.
Thanks.
And I really appreciate all the comments by everybody today. The thing that you were talking about earlier about healing and how we can retain some civility, and I think we at one point had it. It wasn't quite romanticized, I don't think, but the thing that's missing is respect. And I think we don't respect one another today because we lack understanding. And, you know, you saw it with 9/11, people not understanding the Muslim world, and immediate hate and wanting to go hunt down, you know, the people who are responsible. And you saw it during the last election. people who were Democrats wouldn't speak to Republicans. No one tried to understand the other person's perspective. And because of that, you didn't have any respect for them. And I see it every day when I teach. You know, children don't respect teachers today. And parents don't respect the teachers either. From a lack of understanding. I really believe that. So maybe a goal is to try to understand and listen to one another. And then maybe respect will come back. Thank you.
You know, Rebecca, as part of the Civil Conversations Project, in the fall, I did an event at Brookings Institution. And we did put this on the air, too. And I interviewed Alice Rivlin and Pete Domenici. And so these are two people who are veterans of our political system and wise actors, a little bit behind the scenes in the budget debate. And that's a word, the word respect is something that they both used as something that they feel has gone missing in life inside the Beltway and how people on both sides of the party aisle interact with each other. And this is one way they talked about it. You know, they said, first of all, in that context, people used to know each other. You might be on the other side of the aisle in policy terms, but you had dinner together. You knew each other's children. So there was a human connection that meant that whatever was going on in policy and debate terms, you assumed good intentions, even if you disagreed. You know, they said there's such a profound difference in what happens when you disagree with someone's positions but respect them as a human being, or when you disagree with someone's positions and therefore call their very character into question, that then you have a completely disintegrating situation where, you know, it's not just that common ground becomes hard to imagine, but again, you know, civility goes by the wayside.
Everybody likes to point to the relationship between Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill as being kind of the quintessential example of this. But we had a great one here in Missouri, too, with Tom Eagleton, former senator, and former Senator John Danforth.
Yeah.
Opposite political parties, but they accomplished a great deal by working together.
And Senator Danforth is just – I heard him talking about this, too, at some point. He, you know, he is also such a voice of that culture that could – contain fierce debate and a stalwart respect for the humanity of the other.
Very well grounded in his Episcopal faith and very active in it, and I think that has a lot to do with his approach to just about everything.
Mm-hmm.
As time gets away, I have an email from Jerry here that we'll wind up with because I think you'll like what he has to say. He said, recently when going through the 1,000 books or so that are threatening to take over my storage space, he's not alone in that, I'm sure, I ran across a title I had forgotten, the title The Ignorance of Certainty. This is, in my opinion, one of the major difficulties we face, and I'm glad to say that I think your perspective is the opposite of that. Unless we question and seek new alternatives to deal with change, we will stay mired and unenlightened. So keep on keeping on.
Well, thank you, Jerry. I do like that.
Yeah. I think that might be Jerry, who is a frequent caller to this program. Just a few seconds left. What's ahead for Krista Tippett? Anything special we should be listening for?
Oh, well, we want to take this Civil Conversations idea farther this year, and we want to actually take it beyond hot-button issues, which seems so obvious. I'd welcome people to write to me and share your thoughts on this or people, voices you have in mind about, you know, what are other big burning subjects that we need to be able to talk about as a culture that we don't have a way to, and you know, something like poverty or the economy.
They can find you through your website.
They can find me at onbeing.org. They can actually find me on Twitter, at Krista Tippett, two P's, two T's. And we're just right now in a period of discernment about that, but excited about the future.
Krista Tippett, Sunday mornings at 10 o'clock right here on St. Louis Public Radio. Thanks for being with us. Have a good evening at McKendree University tonight.
Oh, it's great
tonight.
To be here. Thank you.
Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about advances in the prevention and treatment of heart disease. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.